You know, people complain about the weather in England, but I actually like being immersed in the countryside, and that includes rain on my cheeks, thankful for a good parka, sheep seeming to sleep standing at attention in the drizzle, the wet, worn wood of a swinging gate as I walk from one farmstead to the next. I see a creamstone village with a medieval church that's kind of standing triumphantly upon what probably was a pagan holy site. And then ahead, I find a warm pub, a welcoming pub. And I step inside. My glasses fog up. And I take off my glasses and I see a gregarious man behind the bar who pulls me a pint. And in moments, I'm immersed in good conversation with new English friends. I'm enjoying the English countryside. I'm joined today by Roy Nichols, who for 30 years has led Americans around the English countryside. And we're going to talk about walking across England. Thanks for joining us, Roy.
It's a pleasure, Rick.
Now, I tried to paint a picture there of sort of the intimate joy of enjoying a lush and intimate and drizzly afternoon in the English countryside. Did that resonate with you at all?
Oh, it certainly does, because most of my walking is spent in the rain. England is a rainy country, or Britain is a rainy country, and you have to accept this. But as you say, it's part of the joys.
It's soft weather, isn't it?
Exactly. There are no extremes of temperature in Britain.
There's no bad weather, just inappropriate clothing.
Exactly. And as long as you're prepared for the weather, you'll still enjoy your walking regardless of the type of weather.
And it makes that pub even more welcoming and cozy.
Exactly. Whether it's summertime and it's a hot day, or during rainy periods, or the cold of a winter's day, to get into a pub at the end of the day or at lunchtime, have a pint, have a meal, it's bliss on earth.
I love a pub. And maybe that's one reason why, according to the surveys and so on, 3/4 of British people consider themselves walkers. It's the most popular outdoor activity in Great Britain.
It is. And whether you're walking just to the pub for a quiet drink on a Sunday afternoon, or whether you're doing one of the serious trails, walking many miles a day, walking is a great institution.
And there are serious trails that are well organized that'll take you literally all the way across England.
Exactly. There are trails in every part of the British Isles, whether it's one running to north to south, like the Pennine Way, whether it's one of the coastal walks, like the Southwest Coastal Footpath that goes 500 miles around the counties of Somerset, Dorset and Cornwall, or whether you're walking one of the local trails.
What's the longest from tip to tip, from Land's End to John O'Groats?
It's about 800 miles. That's an unofficial footpath, and there isn't actually a designated route, but it's a route that many people take to do charitable runs or cycles or drives. Yeah.
Now, that is literally from Land's End, that's the southwest tip of Cornwall, all the way up to the
top very northeast point on the British mainland.
Called John O'Groats.
John O'Groats. It's a little settlement.
800 miles.
800 miles. A little bit more, but yeah. 800 miles.
Now, it's nothing new. There's a Ramblers Association that has really been a group of hikers that appreciate this sort of right, a basic right that people have to walk across the countryside in England. It was founded way back in the 1930s.
Exactly. Now, walking, as we've said, has been a passion of the British for a long time. By the 1930s, much of the land being owned by great landowners was denied, or access was denied to these areas. And what the Ramblers Association was trying to do was establish the right of access to these areas.
So during the Industrial Revolution, more and more fences, more and more stay out signs.
Exactly.
And the people who really had that right, all the way back to medieval times when you had commons lands or whatever, said, no, this is open to people to walk through. You can own the land, but you can't fence it off. And they organized in the Ramblers Association. Today, there's, 800 groups, 140,000 members, and they are still asserting the right of the people to walk. As a matter of fact, back in the 30s, they organized an actual
mass trespass. Exactly.
A mass trespass.
There's a place in the Peak District called Kinder Scout, and I think that was the first place where they actually organized one of these mass trespasses.
So what is a mass trespass?
Where thousands of people essentially are breaking the law of the land against the law of trespass, where they walked across land that was privately owned to establish the right to walk. And although there were prosecutions at the time, eventually it did lead to the establishment of the Peak District National Park, or helped to contribute.
That's quite heroic, really.
It is. It is about the rights of access to the countryside for all of us. Now, it's no dispute of private ownership by any means, but the countryside is part of our heritage. It's a recreation that, as we said, most people enjoy. And so access to the countryside is important.
So as travelers, when we visit England, we can get into this sort of enthusiasm and appreciation for walking through the countryside. And we can be thankful for the Ramblers Association, because when we get to England, we find it's got to be one of the most walker-friendly countries in the world. The trails are well-groomed, well-marked.
There are hundreds of thousands of miles of public footpaths in the countryside. Now, these, as we've said, might be the long-distance trails, but there are thousands and thousands of little footpaths that go from village to village, from house to house. These were established in medieval times, or from medieval times. And so There is nowhere in the countryside where you can't walk.
And you got these wonderful characteristic signposts.
Oh, yeah, the beautiful signposts. There are little wooden signs, usually sometimes cast iron, that point to the next village, giving you the destination.
I've got so many photographs of these. I'm just a sucker for these signs, these beautiful little hand-carved signs.
And in fact, one thing
almost.
You do look for is the little acorn.
What is that?
Where you've got a long-distance footpath, the acorn is the designated symbol indicating long-distance footpath or the route
of it. Is that right?
It.
And is that associated with the Ramblers Association?
No, it's something done by sort of people like the national parks. And there are various other signs as well. When you've got local trains, they'll have a little symbol indicating the extent or the direction of the footpath.
England has a passion for food that does not make you thin. And there's a lot of fat people in England, and I would think that there'd be sort of an enthusiasm for getting out there and walking it
off. Exactly, partly because of the sort of the background of the food type, but also because of modern life. And we just aren't as active as our ancestors used to be. And obesity is a problem everywhere in the Western world. Walking is really this answer to it.
Now, when you're in England, you've got a chance to go to all sorts of different sort of terrains. And it's confusing to me. You've got commons, you've got moorlands, heaths, downlands. What do these things mean?
Much of it is all really different names for different types of upland. Downs is an old Anglo-Saxon word meaning a hill. You find it down in the south and southeast of England.
Downs is a hill.
Yes, an old Saxon word meaning hill.
Counterintuitive.
So you go up the down.
You go up the down. I'm going to go up the down. South Downs. South Downs. That's one of my
favorite
parts of England.
Or the Wiltshire Downs. And in fact, you can go down the down as well.
Down the down. What about moorlands?
Moorlands are these traditional heathy, sort of heathery type countryside.
Nice place for sheep and goats.
Exactly. But it's some of the most accessible, open, undeveloped, unspoiled parts of Britain.
Now, there's like, what, 10 national parks in England?
Exactly,
these,
ranging from the Northumberland National Park in the northeast, down through the Lake District, down through the Yorkshire Moors, the Yorkshire Dales, down to the South Downs. And I think one of the most recent is the South Downs and the New Forest.
That's a national park, South Downs?
Yeah, it is. I think it came into being this last year.
Beautiful. I love the South Downs. That should be protected as a national park. That's the area around Brighton, sort of, south of
exactly,
London.
From Eastbourne right through across to the west in Winchester.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're walking across England with Roy Nichols, who's been doing that for a long time.
All my life.
All your life. Roy, what is a heath?
A heath is a very sort of generic term for a sandy area. You'll find a lot of it in the southeast of England.
Would it be near the coast?
Not always, because there are parts of, for instance, East Anglia, which are heathland.
Because you've got these links in Ireland for golfers, right?
Well, a golf course that is by the coast is by designation a links.
Is that unique to Ireland or Scotland also? Do you know?
Well, I think it comes from the fact that one of the first golf courses was St Andrews in the northeast of Scotland, of course, was on the coast.
And because of the sandy coastal kind of ground.
Exactly. And many kind of the sort of the traps and the bunkers and things, of course, were sand.
Beautiful
sand
golfing area. And of course, golfing born in Scotland and very popular to this day. And finally, what is a commons?
A commons was an area of land that was once upon a time, really from medieval times, was actually owned by the community. Everybody had access to graze their animals on it, collect firewood, all of this sort of thing.
So this does go back to the medieval times.
The feudal system.
It was
a resource for the village or the town. Sadly, much of this was taken away in the 17th and 18th centuries by what they called the enclosures, where land was parcelled up and sold off.
So it was a way that poor landless people would have a place to graze their flocks
exactly.
And sustain
they
themselves.
Exactly. They were farmers by
and
default.
And to this day, you've got these commons that are sort of mystical communal parklands, it seems like, where there's not a lot of development. Is there not a lot of development there because it's just miserable land and sparse population or because of government protection?
Well, it's a mixture of all of them. I mean, by, you know, historically, much of this land was bad farming land or not very good, as marginal land. And so there wasn't any pressure on it to turn it into agricultural land. But also it is protected, or much of it is protected these days from development.
You know, English people are quite good at organizing to protect things. And this is part of the role of the Ramblers Association, but you're protecting your coastline so people can have access to it.
Exactly. The National Trust is trying to, I think it's called Operation Neptune. They're trying to buy up more and more of the English coastline. And I think they've got something like 3,000 miles of it or something.
That's a beautiful thing. And you've got these ancient footpaths that are recognized now, and they're just a fragile remnant of what they were, but they still are recognized and being preserved.
Yes. One of the most famous is the Ridgeway, which runs from close to Avebury in Wiltshire right through the northeast, goes about 150 miles, and it's thought to be one of the great prehistoric trackways.
Wow.
These were trackways used thousands of years ago by our ancestors to move around the countryside.
Literally thousands of years ago, centuries before Christ.
Probably from Mesolithic times.
Wow.
Because they're often run along sort of high land, ridges and all that sort of thing, crossing river valleys at convenient places. So they would have been traditional routes of movement.
There's another ancient footpath that sort of historically divides England from Wales, right? Offa's Dyke?
Offa's Dyke. Offa's Dyke is named after an early Saxon king called King Offa, one of the last pagan kings of the Kingdom of Mercia. He was having trouble with the Welsh, so he built a large ditch and embankment that ran right from the north of the border, right to the south of the border, and no Welshman was meant to cross the boundary.
So this was to keep those
troublesome
Welsh on
at a distance,
land.
Yeah.
It was worse land anyways than England, and he still had to...
And that's one of the reasons why they tried to cross over and steal our cattle.
So you had to keep them there. Today, I don't think you need Offa's Dyke anymore.
No, we're all friends.
That's good.
But there is a footpath that runs. It's actually the footpath, which again was established some decades ago, to allow people to walk the length of this old embankment, this old
boundary. A beautiful experience. Offa's Dyke, the historical division between England and Wales. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm talking with Roy Nichols about walking in England. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Julie is calling us from St. Paul, Minnesota. Julie, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Rick.
What's the thought on this hiking in England?
Well, for my 50th birthday, I was telling my husband and friends that I wanted to go up to Northumberland and follow the Hadrian's Wall Path. And as it turned out, six of our friends decided it sounded like a great idea, and they came along with us.
And how was your experience?
Fantastic.
You walked all the way across England from one coast to the other?
No, we ended up staying near Haltwhistle, which was in the center of the wall, or sort of the most picturesque area.
Uh-huh.
And then embarked on foot or on bicycles from our cottages and walked both directions, basically from the center of the wall, about halfway each way.
Nice. Roy, what's your advice for somebody who wants to walk along Hadrian's Wall, that 1,800-year-old wall the Romans built from coast to coast to define the north edge of the empire?
Oh, it has to be one of the most romantic and dramatic walks in England. It runs for something close to 80 miles, as we say, from the west to the east. It's actually a very relatively recent walk, last 10, 15, 20 years, something like that. And there's all sorts of systems to allow walkers to actually walk along the wall. There are shuttle services from various towns, usually confined to the summer months when most people are doing their walks. There are guides to the wall itself, telling you where there are places to stop for bed and breakfast and transport facilities and all those sort of things. So it really does help the ordinary walker to make it possible.
And you can punctuate the walk with quite impressive Roman attractions.
Exactly, because, you know, some of the best preserved Roman remains in Britain. You've got the famous Roman forts of places like Housestead and Chester's, but also civilian settlements at places like Vindolanda.
And this wall was quite an engineering feat. They had it well figured out. What was the sort of big picture for this wall from a Roman engineer's point of view?
Well, it was really really about the Emperor Hadrian, really in the early 2nd century, defining the boundaries of the Roman Empire. After centuries of expansion, he was defining the boundaries once and for all.
They had like big castles and then every mile a little castle, and you could take your chariots along the top of the wall. Is that right?
Well, that's a popular misconception. It was actually only one for sort of walking along. Mm-hmm. But essentially, you have a stone wall with the ditch to the north, a ditch and embankment, and a road to the south. And it was really a great linear fortification to divide the north to the south. Also acting as a customs post for people moving north and south, but also making sure that powerful tribes to the north and south didn't combine and thereby threaten the power of the Romans.
So, Julie, when you were hiking Hadrian's Wall, what sort of evocative Roman kind of experiences did you enjoy?
Well, we happened to be there during the reign of the century. So we had rain every day, and we got to be outdoors walking along the wall and probably experiencing the cold and wind and rain that the Romans, I'm sure, didn't appreciate.
That, to me, is quite an evocative thing, to think of a Roman standing there on that wall in a driving rainstorm with a parka that was technology from 1,800 years ago.
Exactly. And what adds a particular poignancy to this is that we know from archaeological evidence that many of the soldiers came from places like Spain and some of the other Mediterranean countries. So imagine being posted to
what
the furthest most outpost of the Roman Empire. So, Julie, I do sympathize with your bad weather, but as you did say, you really are experiencing the weather that the Romans experienced 2,000 years ago.
It amazed us that in our hometowns, none of us would go out and do any exploring in a rainstorm, but we didn't hesitate to go as far as we could on any given day and get soaked and and come back and have wonderful dinners together. It was perfect.
You cannot be a fair weather walker in England. You got to face the weather, get out there, and remember that there's five or six different weathers in the course of one day.
As Rick says, it's so changeable. And think of the joys of finishing a day's walking, changing a hot bath, a hot shower, a hot meal, and a pint of beer. What could be better?
Not much.
Julie, thanks for your call.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're exploring England on foot with my friend Roy Nichols, who's been doing that all his life and for 30 years as a tour guide. Roy, I just want to cover a few points about hiking in England and enjoying the countryside very briefly and very quickly. First of all, you've got all these wonderful varieties of gates that let you cross from one man's property to the next.
Yeah, there's whole different varieties and things. Stiles is a very favourite one, which is a very simple system of having posts and a horizontal plank where you just step up onto the plank, cross over the fence and down the other side. There are various gateways, some gateways built really for riders to get through with bars to allow them to...
The idea is to let humans get through, but not the farm animals.
Exactly, that's right. To allow sort of passage along public footpaths without letting stock out.
Isn't one of the gates designed for romance?
Oh, you're talking about the famous kissing gate. That's right. This is like a little turnstile assembly whereby traditionally what would happen is the man would allow his girlfriend to go forward but keep the gate closed and then not allow her to pass through properly without giving him a kiss.
A delightful way to cheer up a day with a little bit of a drizzle. What about the hedgerows? There's a lot of fascinating wildlife or just life in the hedgerows.
Well, many hedgerows date back thousands of years, particularly to times like the Bronze Age, but most of the hedgerows you see in England today are a product of medieval times or of the 18th century during the enclosures period. They are essentially stock-proof fences to prevent stock from moving from field to field. But as you say, they are great refuges for wildlife. They are historical in their own right. Many of them go back, as I say, centuries.
And these are intimate angles on the English countryside that a walker, I would imagine an English walker, would be well-versed to appreciate. Tell me about human wildlife, these Morris dancers.
There was a great revival in the 19th century of English folk dancing. And it's said that the word Morris is said to be a corruption of Moorish, the Moors from Spain, because this was folk dancing from pre-Christian times. And because they didn't really understand what pagan meant by this period, they thought it had to have been something foreign from abroad. So it's said to be Moorish dancing.
Into this distant, distant past, and it's often so confused because it's just shrouded in the mist of the Dark Ages. For instance, you can be walking across Dartmoor and come to your own private stone circle like Stonehenge without any tourists in sight, and then later on you can come to a clapper bridge. I find these clapper bridges quite evocative.
Clapper bridges, again, there are many of them across places like Exmoor and Dartmoor. They can date to medieval times, but they can even be much older than that. And essentially all they are horizontal slabs of stone supported by columns of stones to allow access across rivers.
I'm Rick Steves. We're speaking with Roy Nichols, who's an English tour guide who spent his lifetime enjoying the English countryside. Roy, of all the hiking you've done, take me and our American listeners to the most remote and exhilarating single place that you've enjoyed as a rambler in the English countryside.
I've had so many good experiences over the years. But I think for romance has to be going back to Offa's Dyke. The walk along Offa's Dyke in the counties of Herefordshire and Shropshire, some of the most beautiful in England.
Just on the edge of Wales?
Just on the edge of Wales.
Why so beautiful?
Well, that's where I was born.
I knew there was an angle like that. Roy Nichols, thank you very much for sharing with us your passion for your own countryside.
It's been my pleasure, Rick.
Rick Steves has spent a third of his adult life in Europe researching and writing guidebooks. His classic, Europe Through the Back Door, teaches the skills of smart travel. At Rick Steves' online travel store, you'll also find guidebooks for London, England, Great Britain, Scotland, and Ireland. To learn more about Rick's guidebooks for this region and beyond, visit the travel store at ricksteves.com.